The MDS's definition of somebody being independent in a task is that over a 7-day window, no help was provided, that the person did it all by themselves, or that help was, says, does on own or aided one or two times only. So here's my question for you. Well, if you go back and look at your ADL grids, or you're looking at your ADLs on your MDSs, and the self-performance is zeros, then here's the question you have to ask yourself. Why are they in your facility? If they require help two times or less out of 160 hours of care, now, I'm not saying that some people are not going to be, because there are some people that you do that are rehab, they're going to be going home, I understand that. But I'm saying just in general, that's what that means. That help was provided two times or less. Two times! You can have two times of help on the night shift. But if you don't collect the number of times, then you're not going to get it. Does that make sense? So if you go down here to the next one, so if you go down the tree, then now it's asking. So that's when you say, well, what kind of help did you provide? Was it weight-bearing help? So that's the question you're asking. Okay, they're saying, okay, oh, come back. You think I can't hear you. I'm like, you know, it's like I'm up here like a duh. Look, she's talking to herself and she can't hear me whispering over. I hear everything. Okay, so weight-bearing assistance. So they're asking, okay, did this person receive through the course of the 7 days any kind of weight-bearing help? And then you would say, well, yeah, they did. Well, they say, or full staff performance. They say, okay, so here's the first question that comes off of that diamond. In order to score somebody on the MDS, as total dependence, which is 4, then it must be, what they say, full staff performance. And that is defined as complete non-participation of the individual. And not just one day, but it's every time. So if I am totally dependent in getting dressed, that you have to do everything, but finally someone says, hey, Andrea, lift up your arm. And I go like this, and I'm able to lift it a little bit like this to put my shirt on, then you cannot score me as a 4 on the MDS because I was not totally dependent every time. So if you scored as a 4, it has to be not every day or every shift or most of the time. There's no averages here. The MDS does not do any average or most representative level, or I have 2 threes and 3 threes and this, and what does that average out to? Wrong answer. You follow this tree and it will tell you what the correct score is every time. So if it was not full staff performance every time, but you say, hey, well, was there weight-bearing help or at least full staff performance at least 3 or more times, then bam, that's the score that goes on the MDS. Thoughts or comments on this?
So number 3 is likely to be the most common.
Right. Could be. She said that there would probably be not many people as being 4 all the time. And I'd probably agree with that because it'd be every single time. And there may not be as many people that are always 100% independent because that means help two times or fewer. So you're probably either a 1, 2, or 3. That's probably the more representative level of functioning in your building. And now, this is what I want to get at. So I'm sitting here talking about ADLs to you today, and you can sit there and say, oh man, maybe we can do this better at our facility. All of a sudden, I go back and you do ADLs different, you think, oh, on the next MDS, it looks like they've had a significant change. Do you do a significant change MDS? And the answer is no. If it truly was not a significant change MDS is done when somebody has had a significant change. Just because you've significantly changed your data does not mean that the resident has changed. You've changed. So don't penalize the resident because of you. But you've got two options. You can either write a note indicating that And you should anyway have a progress note, like in the MDS tab of your chart, or the MDS section. You should have a progress note that you keep in there that you don't thin off. And maybe what I would do is say, while it appears that the resident had significant decline in these three ADLs, the resident has not declined, but based on new data collection, that there's now a more representative level of their functioning. And so you could indicate that, and you could even, based on, if the care plan was wrong, based on the bad data you collected, you could do a significant correction. You've got that choice as well. But don't do a significant change just because the data changed. The only time you do a significant change of status is when the resident changes. Yes? How far back do you go with a significant correction? A significant correction MDS only significantly corrects the preceding MDS if it was a major change. I would not go, you know what, you go back and you could change everything. I would probably from this point forward move on. You know, I wouldn't say that, because you could go back and you could change, you could spend 1,000 hours going back and modifying this and modifying that. If I were just you, honestly, I would just go forward from this point on. Now, please be aware. Please be aware that your quality measures and quality indicators will go down the tank. Because it's going to appear like, oh my gosh, everybody's declining that facility. Well, it'll be that way for a quarter until you're back on track. Okay? So just tell somebody, yeah, it's going to appear that way for a little while, but don't blow a gasket. That it's just simply trying to, we're trying to even this out now. Okay? This whole ADL section, and I would not leave this to one, the CNAs by themselves to do this. Because let me give you an example. I'm blown up. If you look at the ADL section, go back and look at section G on the MDS, and I want to show you some of these definitions. The four late loss ADLs, when I talk about Shrek, let's talk about this. I do want to talk about this, that, you know, the codings, you can read the codings on your own, but like, look at bed mobility. Now, remember I told you these are like onions, because onions have layers. Well, if you're going to interview somebody, or you're going to create a document to collect this data, then you have to ask the staff three questions as they pertain to bed mobility. Because the definition of bed mobility is based on three things. A, turning from side to side. B, moving to and from a lying position. And C or three, whatever I said before, the other two were. That it's how they reposition themselves in bed. Now, you have to consider all three of the definitions. Why? Because I go to a children's home outside of Indianapolis. And they were coding their infants as independent bed mobility. And I said, how can that be? And they go, well, because they can turn over side to side by themselves. And I said, well, how about sitting up or laying down? Oh, they need our, we do that for them. Now it's extensive assistance because part of the definition of bed mobility required physical weight-bearing help on behalf of the staff. But if you don't ask, all different people were asking different questions. You need to have one assessor say, how did they move to and from a lying position? How did they turn back and forth and side to side in bed? Or when they scooted down, how did you get them back up? Or how did they get back up? You have to ask all three. The CNAs know this stuff, but they're not gonna say, well, let me tell you what I did in bed mobility in these three areas for you. They're not gonna tell you all three of those definitions. And they get progressively harder. Transfer is how they move from point A to point B, but guess what? It also includes standing. So if I can get from point A to point B, but I can't get up out of my chair unless you physically help me, guess what? That's part of transfer, so that'd be part of the definition. Same with eating and toilet use is incredible because it has many layers, from going on and off the commode, to the use of the urinal, to the catheter, to the ostomy, to adjusting clothing, to cleansing themselves and washing their hands. Yeah, transfer on off the commode. It's all part of the definition, but unless someone knows to ask all of those questions, you might be missing out. So the question is that one, and God love the CNAs, but they're, like I said, they are the hardest working people, but they are the least educated in this process. They know the least amount about this MDS and all these goofy things. So if you just take a snapshot of the MDS and you throw it on a form, they're not going to get it just because it's in a bigger font. Does it mean like, oh, it's in bigger font now. Now I get it. That's just like if someone doesn't understand English, you think that by raising your voice, they'll now get it. No, I still don't process. So just by making bigger font or prettier letters doesn't mean they're going to get it. So the key is that this is mandatory training, and I would not just let anybody score this. You know, maybe you have ADL mentors. Maybe you take certain CNAs on each shift, and you give them more training, a little extra money per hour, but they're mentors now on ADLs. They've been given this training that puts them a cut above, something where you have people there that they can bounce ideas off of. All right. The key for this one on ADLs is, number one, is you have to gather information from multiple sources. So not just the MDS coordinator going and asking on the seventh day, but you want people over multiple, because you know what? If it happened one time they required help this shift, and 2 days later on a different shift they required extensive assistance, and then 2 days later on another shift they required extensive assistance over 7 days, it happened 3 times. That's the score that goes on the MDS. With the exception of total dependence, which has to be every time. Ask questions pertaining to all aspects of the definition, not just, hey, how did it turn from side to side? So that means that the interviewer has to understand the layers of every single one of those ADL tasks. This is not easy stuff. This is not simple, I can teach you once and you get it. And then it's not necessary to know the actual number of times the activity occurred. It is necessary to know whether or not the activity occurred 3 or more times. And I took that right out of the manual. So I'm not making any of this stuff up. Okay? Are you guys ready for some refreshments? All right, why don't you take just a quick break. Back out there, they've got some whatever it is for you guys. Food Pop, Bake Alaska. What's wrong? The key is to use the ADL self-performance tree for scoring self-performance. You need to focus on occurrences. It's a team effort. So not just what happened this shift, but what happened all the shifts. And this one requires quarterly in-servicing, like you would not believe. Modes of transfer, I'm going to pick up the speed a little bit on some of these. Modes of transfer is for Bedfast. And the key for this one is that it's immaterial to the MDS on whether it was their choice to stay in bed or your choice. It's just saying that, gosh, if they're in bed the whole time, then they have possible problems with social isolation or mobility issues. And so here's the key on this one. This is a rule out question. If none of these exist, or if one of these does not exist, then the answer, you would not code it on the MDS. In bed or a recliner is one. In his or her own room, that's number two. If the above two items, then it has to be 22 hours or more of the day. Okay? But then if that's true, then if the above three, then the above occurred at least 4 days out of the 7 day look back period. Doesn't have to be consecutive days, but just 4 days. So you might have this, this, and this, but it only happened 2 days. So you wouldn't code it on the MDS. Any questions on that? It's fairly straightforward. Continence. This is section H. We talked about this a little bit on bowel and bladder. This over the last 14 days. The key for this one, too, is you've got the 5-point scale, but you also have to include in there if they're using appliances or on a program. So this is where most of your staff won't realize that if someone has a catheter and it does not leak, then they're considered to be continent. But that's kind of backwards for some nursing staff. They think, well, aren't they incontinent because that's why we gave them a catheter? Well, if the catheter's in and it's not leaking, then they're considered continent. You might have a person who's incontinent, but you have them on a scheduled toileting plan. And so because they're on that plan, that they stay dry, so they are continent. So you have to consider if appliances or programs in place to figure out their level of wet to dry. Okay? And so the key for this one, too, is look at your data collection forms and see if they flow with the number of times on the MDS. There's a 5-point scale. Again, I've pointed out, you know, once a week, 2 times a week. So again, look back at however you're collecting continents in your facility and ensure that you're tracking it the way the MDS is asking for that. Any questions on continents? This is kind of interesting. You want to make sure you're doing multiple sources and multiple shifts. But somebody asked the federal government what the definition of wet was. That's amazingly so. With somebody a couple of years back said, what was the definition of wet? And they answered them. They said that wet, when you consider for incontinence, that if the resident's skin gets wet with urine or if whatever is next to the skin, i.e. pad, brief, or underwear gets wet, it should be counted as an episode of incontinence regardless of the amount. So even if they dribble, and we're not talking basketball, we're talking like with urine, they dribble, then it's considered incontinent. Okay? Here's a little funny FYI for you. In Section H2 talks about constipation or regular and so forth. What is the definition, according to this, of someone who's regular? Okay, one bowel movement every 3 days. All right, so how many times a week is that? What's the definition of constipation? It's 2 or fewer bowel movements a week. So if they go every 3 days, they are regularly constipated. And it's true. I mean, look it up. That's the definition of regular, and that's the definition of constipated. So I don't know which way you code. You can code both, I guess. Ingoing catheter, this is not a big deal. But the fact is, the only problem with this one is that you would code for a catheter that was ever present in that 14-day window, regardless of whether it's still present at the end of the observation period. It's just that if any time during a 14-day look back, and this includes hospitalizations or out of the building, any time that during the any time that they have it, they have a catheter, then you code it on the MDS. Yeah. End of story. Right. Yes. Correct. You'd also code it as incontinent that they're going to have a catheter in there, but you'd look to see, you know, charting would show you when the catheter came out and so forth. But yeah, they're going to be, if it came out, then they're, if in the part of the week they were with the catheter in and the other part of the week they were incontinent, then you go for the number of times, the frequency of incontinency. Yep, it'd be incontinent. Yep. This is just a quick note on ostomy, which is H3I. This is the presence of an ostomy, and the key for this one, I'm not going to go a lot of detail, but these are all the ostomies that are used for elimination. Colostomy, ileostomy. This is not a tube feed. A lot of people, because tube feedings are ostomies, they'd want to put them here, and this is elimination, not feeding. Okay? Diseases, this is section I1 on the MDS, and this is where you are checking those diseases that are present that somehow are affecting the individual, whether it's emotionally, physically, medically, you're monitoring for. Somehow these are active care plan issues, okay? And they say that for all the diagnoses that are listed in I1, there has to be a physician diagnosis to support the coding of that. All right, that's cool. And that conditions are no longer affecting the individual, they should not be coded on the MDS. And that's where, you know, where I talk about diabetes and peripheral vascular disease. Now, have any of you seen what they did with these section I for the MDS 3.0? What they did was, see, right now in section I1, you just check, right? And then I3 is the companion to I1. I3 is that, well, if you had a disease that wasn't listed in I1, well, then you could just put in the ICD-9 code in I3. Well, in the MDS 3.0, all of your diseases are ICD-9 codes. So instead of saying diabetes, you have to actually know the type and if it's affecting something. So that means that it has to be very, I mean, that's what they propose. Whether or not that's going to come to fruition, I can't tell you. But as an FYI, that's an FYI. All right. UTI, I think we already talked about this, that in the last 30 days, it's I2, that you have to have those three key pieces for to code UTI on the MDS. So symptoms, significant laboratory findings, and physician diagnosis. Now, they did indicate that if you are waiting for significant laboratory findings during the window and the window's now closed and you still don't have results back yet, the physician's working diagnosis of UTI will allow you to code UTI on the MDS. However, if the laboratory findings come back not indicating a UTI, then you would have to then modify that record to take off a UTI, which that's to your benefit. I mean, it's to your benefit. So again, there's nothing, you know, don't read more into this than what it is. It's this, if those three things are present in the last 30 days, you code it. If they're not present, you don't code it. That's pretty simple. The ICD-9 code, this was, remember we talked about all the malnutrition things that would put you at high risk for pressure ulcers? Well, just as an FYI, so the ICD-9 codes are listed in I3 of the MDS, and so, again, anything that you don't find in I1, the diseases or infections that are currently affecting the resident, then somebody would can put those ICD-9 codes in section I3. So this is where you'd find the malnutrition ones. But just as an FYI, so you'd want to probably have a person who knew ICD-9 codes well. That's a very detailed art form, and I know nothing about ICD-9 codes, really. Pain on the MDS is section J2, if you go there. All this does, in all honesty, is over a 7-day window records the frequency and the highest intensity of pain. It does not indicate pain management. It doesn't do any of that. All it does is that it captures symptoms of pain and the frequency that they had it. Basically is what it is. Pain is whatever the resident says it is. You're looking back at the nurse's notes or the medication record to find this. But this is the key piece on this, is that all it's asking those straight questions. Did they have pain or show pain? And what was the frequency of that? So if you have people that are on pain management programs, and during that 7 days they didn't complain of pain and you didn't visualize pain, then on the MDS it'd be no pain. You're giving it for pain, but if they've not described or displayed any pain, you don't mark it. Okay? So frequency is the frequency with which either you saw it or they verbalized pain. And that's pretty simple. Either no pain, less than daily or daily. I mean, that's pretty simple. And then you code for the highest level of pain. So hopefully you've got pain scales in place. If you don't, I would contact iPro. You check out the MedQuick website. These are places that have offered scales for you for pain. The key for this, though, is whatever scale you use, that if it's indicative of a level of pain, then that level of pain has to crosswalk back to the MDS. So if it's a 1 through 10 or 1 through 5 or smiley faces or whatever it is that you're using, you know, what does smiley face number 6 mean? Does that mean mild, moderate, or excruciating? You have to know how that crosswalks to the MDS. These are kind of interesting definitions, if you wouldn't mind, I'm going to explain it to you. Mild means a little bit of pain. They've got pain, but they can obviously work through that and still do their daily routines. Number 3 is excruciating or horrible. That means that it's pain that interferes with whatever it is that they're doing. And the definition for moderate pain is medium pain. So moderate is medium. So that's about as clear as mud, isn't it? It's just that doesn't really, I don't know what that means, but moderate is medium. So the keys for pain is you have to educate your staff to make sure that they're looking for pain symptoms as well. A lot of people are not going to tell you they're in pain. They're not going to verbalize it at all. Either they can't or they won't. So it's up to you to have good visual skills to see if you're looking at have symptoms of pain. Crosswalk to the MDS and make sure that you're documenting pain. No falls. This is one of the risk factors? This is J4 on the MDS. We're moving right along here. J4 on the MDS is falls, and the definition of falls by the federal government and your definition are two different things. If you intercept a fall where the person would have fallen but you caught them, it's a fall. Regardless of whether they have injury with a fall, it should be coded as a fall. If you find them on the floor and you don't know how they got there, it's a fall. The distance to the next lower surface, in this case the floor, is not a factor in determining whether a fall occurs. So if they're on a low mattress and they roll off the mattress onto the floor, it's a fall. So that may not be a definition that everybody knows in your building, so please make sure that they are aware that these are the definitions that the government has, and this is how you code the fall, a fall, on the MDS. Yes? Okay, question back up on the pain part. I'm sorry? Well, I would say that what's the scale that you're using to get? She's talking. Oh, hang on, let me make sure I talk about the question. She was talking about in her facility that they do rehab, and these people are taking like Lortab or was it Darvocets or Percocets, happy pills, and for their pain. And is it because it's on the physician's orders? Is that for moderate pain? Is that how? But these people are able to ask for it, and it doesn't interfere with their functioning. So maybe I would ask the resident to describe the pain that they have. That would be first to me, is that you've asked for something for pain. Please describe your pain to me. What is it? Are you using a scale right now, 1 to 10 or 1 to 5? So I would say whatever that your scale should crosswalk to the MDS. So let's say, for instance, I don't know what your scale is, but let's say, for instance, my scale is that if I scored it as a 1, 2, or 3, it's going to be mild. A 4, 5, and 6 might be moderate, and 7, 8, 9, 10 is going to be excruciating. I don't know, excruciating. But I guess I would try to ask them to describe their pain, and then based on their description of the pain would be how I would score it on the MDS. Well, and again, she said that they're describing it as a 6 or 7, and I think that's got to be the issue, is that it's got to be, even though they're able to still perform their functions, you have to be able to document what the resident says their level of pain is. Everyone's going to have different pain thresholds, and what one person's threshold is going to be, even though they're still able to perform it, I still think that you have to base it on what the resident describes as their pain. Well, but you have to realize too, come back. It may make your numbers, unfortunately though, that I would explain that you have a lot of, maybe you have a big caseload for rehab people, that you have a lot of hips or knees or whatever kind of fractures, and that, it takes that level of, they're experiencing the pain. And so I don't think it's a bad thing. I think they're just looking to see, and again, the public won't know per se what you're looking at, but that's where you have an opportunity to educate. And again, this is not the perfect system in the world. It's just you have to do with it what you can. And so your numbers may not look the best, but it's based on your population, and I would certainly tell the public that if they ask. Okay. All right. Oh, one of my favorite questions. End-stage disease. Now, this is in section J5, this is letter C. And let me explain to you the critical piece on this one. In one's clinical judgment, the resident with any end-stage disease has 6 or fewer months to live. And you see the key piece there is the clinical judgment. The judgment of the clinical team. And it says, but here's the key. In order for you to mark this on the MDS for end-stage disease, well, first of all, you have to have an end-stage disease. But the doctor has to certify that the resident has 6 or fewer months to live. Now, you just can't say hospice. You say, well, definition of hospice is 6 or fewer months to live. The doctor has to write that the person has 6 or fewer months to live. There has to be written someplace that indicates this person has 6 or fewer months to live. If the doctor's certification does not say this someplace, then you can't take credit for it on the MDS. And the reason why they want to go that degree is because if they truly are in that end stage of life, then everything is going to start to deteriorate. And why should you be held accountable for poor care if it's based on a disease process? And you may have some physicians that are reluctant to do this. Again, another reason why you educate that this is a clinical judgment that you go by. Because you know what? There's only, no one knows exactly when each of us are going to die. There's only one person that knows that, right? That's God. And I had somebody say, well, they marked it on, you know, what happens if they mark it on the MDS and 6 months down the road, that person is still here? I said, well, you walk into the room and you kill them. You walk in and you kill them. The assessment said they're supposed to be dead. You're just doing what the assessment says. You go in and you kill them. I said, what do you think you do? Because you know, you've probably had it happen where you've had it where someone's been on desk or you think, oh my gosh, you're not going to hang on, and poof, the next day they're eating like a sirloin steak, you know, and they eat a whole pizza by themselves. And then you have some people that they tell you so-and-so died, and you said, what? And you can hardly believe it, right? Because they look fine. And so no one can predict when someone's going to die. At least that's why they say in a clinical judgment, you know. And so anyway, as you can realize, end-stage disease will exclude you from any of the quality measures because you're at the end stage of your life. Now, you can't say, well, what happens if, can I just do it by a diagnosis? You cannot. You can't say end-stage real disease because they can live for years. You know, Alzheimer's is terminal, but it could be years. All of us in this room, we're all terminal. Aren't we? I mean, when you think about it, we are. We just don't know what, you know. This is trying to say, well, we think it's kind of coming soon. This is where talking to your physician is very helpful beforehand. Don't wait till you get to the point where you say, oh, can you do this for us now? Be proactive and say, hey, when we have people that are like this, in order for us to take credit for this and to alleviate us from living all these measures, then we would ask your assistance to document this kind of information. And do it ahead of time. Don't wait till that and say, can you do it for me now? Okay, because I think if people get tired when they get pushed. So, okay. Leave 25% of food. This is one of those mood scale items. This was in for the mood scale score. This is over in section K4C. Leaves 25% of food uneaten in most meals. And this one's over the dietary section. But this would be a great competency test question for your dietary person because it says eat less than 75%. Okay, so they're leaving most of their food, right? You're only eating 25% of their food. And then, but the key is, there's two key pieces of this. First of all, who's tracking the percentage of food consumed? Because one person's 50% and another person's 50% could be two different things. So it's education on figuring out percentages of food intake. But also for this one, it's 2 out of 3 meals a day. So it's not one meal or all meals, it's at least 2 out of 3 meals, in my personal opinion, all 7 days. Okay? So communicate with direct caregivers, make sure that they're coding it correctly for percentages, and then note 2 out of 3 meals a day. Pressure ulcer, this is M2A. And this is where you've noted the staging of these pressure areas, and you're coding on the MDS the highest stage present in the last 7 days of any ulcer who you've deemed the cause to be unrelieved pressure. Pressure was the cause of that. And so the key for me to you to find out is, how is your staff determining the etiology or the cause of open areas? If you're guessing or you don't know, please make sure you're not doing that because some can be caused by circulatory problems, some can be caused by injury, some can be caused by diseases. And you want to rule out those other ones to make sure you're not coding it under pressure. Pressure ulcer, M2A, is the cause of pressure. Okay? And this would be another in-service I would give, because the MDS does not follow current standards of practice. They've done a very nice job in the training manual about talking about what is causing a pressure ulcer and what you can consider. And this is a great in-service that I would give my staff, because current standards of practice say do not reverse stage. The MDS asks you to reverse stage. So you want to be able to explain to your staff that, yeah, we've got two different standards going on here, and the MDS asks for this. They ask why. You say, well, that's what they're asking for. Because in all honesty, that they want to see the ulcer as it presents itself. And that's not a bad thing for you, because you can show improvement over time. If you keep saying a healing stage 3, then they're not going to see improvement, right? But if you all of a sudden say it's a stage 3 that presents itself as a stage 2, then you're showing levels of improvement. Ulcer history, this is one of the risk factors for the pressure ulcers, and this is that did they have an ulcer that was resolved in the last 90 days? You really want to find out, you want to check the charts, talk to family, because the greatest risk factor for having an open area is having a history of having one. If you had it before, there's a good chance that you'll have it again. And so this is key, so please make sure that you do it a good job of being like little investigators to find out if over the last 90 days they've had an ulcer that has been resolved. Okay? Hospice. Let me throw up for you. I'm not gonna throw up, but let me barf for you. All right. Here you go. This is the training manual, update as of June 2004. So this just came out. Okay, this came out yesterday. I got it last night. This is talking about hospice care. Okay, hospice care is the resident is identified as being in a hospice program for terminally ill persons where an array of services is necessary for the palliation and management of terminal illness and related conditions. The hospice must be licensed by the state as a hospice provider and or certified under the Medicare program as a hospice provider. So that is now the new definition for hospice. Because before it said, a program, and so you could say, well, gosh, can I make my own program then and get credit for it? Because if that was the case, then all you would have hospice programs and be excluding everybody from the quality measures. But this is very specific, as that they're in a hospice program. So now you can see where keeping up on this information is going to be very important for coding the MDS. Is it fifth in rate in advance? All right. So this would replace, so what they'll do is if they've reprinted, and so here's now the page of the manual that's not going to be reprinted. I make a suggestion to you. I'm not sure what kind of MDS training manuals you have back at your facility, whether it's from Briggs or MedPass or a bound edition. But I'd make a suggestion to you that I would have a 3-ring binder of one, because you can't replace the pages of a, I have a Briggs manual that's a cute little copy, but it doesn't do me any good when it's sort of been changed now 3 times. And I can't, it's hard to keep, I can't just shove the papers in there. It's not going to work. So I make a suggestion that somebody is responsible for keeping this up. And it's a large task, but you know what? That's going to change how you code something on the MDS. And that has big implications, especially now for quality measures. So this definition, so what the definition that you have, you can put big X's through what I gave you before, because it just changed as of yesterday. Okay? So that's, you can put a big fat X through that, because it's not right anymore. Physical restraints. I think this is our last one. A physical restraints is P4 on the MDS. You're coding the things in this section that have the effect of restraining, not your intent. You may have somebody that has full side rails up because they've asked for them, because they feel better having them up, but they can't remove them or can't get them down. Guess what? It's a restraint. You may have somebody who cannot move at all, but you put them in a reclining Jerry chair. But the purpose is not to, you know, restrict their movement, and it's not actually restricting their movement because they couldn't get up before. So guess what? The Jerry chair is not a restraint. But this is another in-service I would give. They've gone through beautifully and told you how to determine if something is considered a restraint or not, beautifully in the manual. They've gone even given you examples for Jerry chairs and Mary Walkers. They've given you many examples for that and what would constitute as a restraint and what would not. But the key for this is that not your intent for the use, but its effect on the individual. For the, you code for the, whether this is a quantitative item, the number of days, so use less than daily or daily. For the quality measure, remember it's daily. For trunk, limb, or chair prevents rising. I want you to read that on your own. But I would say of your in-services, that's what I would look at. Remember, delirium, ulcers, restraints. So I'm going to give you some strategies for success. Okay? For your quality measures, please download them quarterly and look at them at some point as a group. Don't do them as an individual, but do them as a group. Be proactive and not reactive with this stuff. We like to wait till, you know, something's gone wrong and then we'll fix it. But even though this is old data, look for trends. And if you start, again, this presentation today is put on by iPro. They brought me in to help you, but they also wanted to tell you that they are here to help you as well. And so if you don't understand something or you need help, please call them. That's why they're here. Focus on MDS accuracy. If you see something screwy, you think, man, we look like crud in that area. Please look at, make sure that you're accurate on your MDSs, because it could simply just be how you're coding the MDS that makes your numbers look skewed. Please, to all the administrators, invest time and energy in training your staff. And DONs, please make the MDS part of your orientation for all new nurses. This is not just the MDS coordinator's job. This is, as you leading the clinical ship, this is your job to ensure that your staff understand how to perform and conduct all these assessments as designed by the RAI. And please do competency testing. Pick and choose questions and answers. It's a great way to figure out what people know and where to focus your training. If you think that you want to create data collection forms, give me a call. I'll give you some hints on what to do and what not to do, okay? Designate staff members. So if you're looking at the data collection forms that you currently have in place, as an FYI for you, please make sure that somebody is, designate someone to look at the accuracy of these, and please don't make it the MDS coordinator. They usually are ones, well, they'll look at the ADL grids on the last seventh day. Well, if there's been copying going on in between, to me, it's the responsibility of the everyday floor nurses that are working to ensure the accuracy of daily information, okay? I'm not going to spend time on documentation right now, but I want to ask you, what questions do you have for me at this point? Yes? Okay, well, I would tell you this right now, is that from the MDS standpoint, is that federally, the MDS is considered a primary source document. Whether your state adopts that is something you're going to have to check with your state coordinator. Like, for example, in Indiana, is that, well, yes, it's federally it is, but the state of Indiana requires that from state law. State rules say that. So I'd say federally, it's viewed as a primary source document. How your state looks at it is something different, but I would tell you right now that the DAVE reviewers, the data assessment verification reviewers, are looking for documentation to support the MDS. So you're better off trying to create data to help support some of the coding that you're doing. Yes. Do I have a phone number or website? Was that in the handouts at all? So the last page or so gives my direct information and how to get a hold of me. If you rather have a business card, I would be more than happy to, if you want a business card, I've got several of them that I'd be more than happy to hand out. Yes. Anybody else? Questions? Okay. Okay. I'll put it up here. I'll put the slide up here right as you're on your way out. So for me, hang on. I want to thank iPro. I want to thank you guys so much. Woohoo! For having me come because. You know, they take a chance, right? They hear some podunk girl near Indiana, right? And so please make sure that when you go home today to do your evaluation online, because it's very important for them to know if you got anything out of today's presentation. It's also helpful for me, okay? So please make sure you do your evaluation. So please, Maureen and those guys, thank you so much for having me come. Tell Pauline, thank you for me. Please make sure that you abuse these people. They want take advantage of them in the back. They want to help you as any way possible. And for me, I hope all of you learned at least one thing new today that you didn't know before, that you always have the opportunity to plant good seeds. So plant good seeds with your MDS process, and you will see a bounty that comes from that if you just invest some time and energy. So from an Indiana girl, have a good day, folks.